Today on the Shift Daily Podcast, Pandora Papers were revealed the richest people in Canada are using tax havens to protect their money. So Michael Smart, professor of economics at the University of Toronto, joins the Shift and tells us how tax havens work and why they are contributing to income equality. We also talk about how we also want to be on that list. Does Mercury retrograde actively impact your day-to-day life? Dave Scott from Spaced Out Radio shares his skepticism on the topic. This is a guy who loves Sasquatch, and he's skeptical. He also dives into some of the biggest Canadian UFO stories in recent memory. And are you okay with spending money? Apparently, we're too cheap.
This is the Shift Podcast.
Are you okay? Well, we've been talking about an awful lot of money here on the Shift. Are you okay with spending money? I love spending money.
Wait. Yeah, way too much. It's just so exciting and fun. And every day can feel like Christmas if you're waiting on a package to come, right? I love it.
I'm usually not okay with spending money. Even when, when I need it, oh, this is filled with guilt. This is like,
really?
I needed that, but I shouldn't have done it. I shouldn't have bought that loaf of bread.
Yeah, I could live without bread this week. Could have made it.
See, I could live without my Kanye West Crocs, but I wear them all the time and I love them. So
yeah,
at least you're not in my shoes, Brendan, literally.
The whole world could live without Kanye West Crocs.
Yeah.
I just go to Payless or whatever took Payless's place.
I did try to find the Kanye West Crocs on like some knockoff Amazon. Like, I tried.
Yeah, I think they took them off.
There's a bunch of them on there. Yeah.
Yeah, definitely.
There was a bunch. Okay. We've heard this before. Got to spend money to make money. You know, we'd also heard before was I don't pay attention to budgetary policy. And budgets balance themselves. Well, tell you what, my finances are evidence that budgets do not balance themselves. So spending money to make money, absolutely the case when it comes to lottery. You got to spend the money on the ticket to make the money on the prize. Just so happens that there was a massive lotto prize on the line in the U.S. recently. Here's more from KBSY News.
If you're feeling lucky, there's a chance to win a life-changing amount of money tonight. Tonight's Powerball drawing is worth an estimated $670 million. That's the biggest lottery prize in more than 8 months. This is after the jackpot rolled over again on Saturday after there was no winner. Powerball has been rolling over for months with the last jackpot hit in June. If someone wins tonight, they could take home a lump sum of $475 million before taxes.
$475 million.
There's your tax haven.
Yeah. You have to pay taxes on that in the States. So, but still, I mean, that would be an okay tax check. A man in Shreveport, Louisiana, didn't win the lottery. He did, however, win a different kind of prize, some laughter. The man, identified only as James, was being interviewed by Corey Johnson of KSLA-TV, a CBS affiliate in Shreveport, when he was a little blunt about what he would spend the near $700 million prize on.
What are you going to do with that money if you win?
Well, I'm definitely going to get a new supercharged Mustang with dual exhaust and about 5 kilos of cocaine, and I'll be good to go.
Okay, so you like cars. You like cars.
Yeah, so you like cars, do you?
Oh, jeez. It's more than a little bump. That's a lot going on there.
Now that's a vaccine bump.
You could say he was revved up and ready to go about that, eh?
Holy. Can we just acknowledge the fact that at least he said it, if that's what he's going to do with it? Because so many people, they win the lottery and they're like, yeah, I'm going to be responsible. And then 6 months later, they're broke. This guy's like, he's going to have his car.
Yeah, he'll get his car. If I won $400 million, I would take all of my best friends and we would just live in Vegas for like a month.
Really?
Really, Vegas? Oh, yeah. Why Vegas?
So did we fall in the best friend circle in this story?
Or before I'm critical of you. You guys can come down. Okay. You guys can come down. I can swap hotels. There's indoor roller coasters. I could see Morrissey every weekend because he has a residency there.
Oh, but you'd be so sad.
See, I don't want to go to Vegas.
I could go to the Dam, Hoover Dam, and I've never been to Vegas. So there you go.
Okay. All right. Well, that's great. Great plan, Rye, with your $400 million. So, I mean, I don't know. What would you, Brendan, what would you spend your money on if you won the $400 million?
I don't even know. I would go a few places. It's difficult now these days. But I would travel if I had, if I was allowed. I would travel a few places. Other than that, I would probably try to make several investments. Maybe start a small business of some sort and continue to live frugally, probably in the exact same place that I am because I have a pretty good discount on rent, and just pretend that I don't really have it and shop at Value Village.
Well, $400 million could get you a nice half a duplex in downtown Vancouver, so that'd be a good start.
Yeah, I'd probably do that.
Could start there, right? Yeah. That's all right. But your party skills, I mean, careful, someone's going to pin a tail on you with your party plan here. I don't know. $400 million. I think it's cool. I mean, I would probably buy the apartments. I'd buy the real estate and you know, get the one in the Huiwi, and probably one in Victoria. I love it there. You know, probably one in Banff. And stuff like that. That's the kind of stuff I would do. I mean, I don't even know if I'd finish the week on the radio show. I'd come back as a guest. He'd be like, yeah, I'm free on Thursday.
That would be a really tough question. You know, you won the lottery. Okay. Can we get 2 weeks out of you before you quit?
Probably not. There's a nice island for sale in Sprott Lake and, you know, just outside Port Alberni. I think that would be a great place to go for, you know, spending some money. And it'd be all right. I mean, I don't know. That's an awful lot of money to think about. I would take it on. And you know what I would do? The first thing I would do is I would find an offshore bank account and I would have my own Pandora Papers release. I would think on myself and be like, hey, here you go, media. Here's all my offshore bank accounts because I finally made the list. It's like the Pandora Papers has become the new Forbes list. We're all striving for it.
I like that. We could just call this the dumpster fire list or something like that. We have to, that's good. You know, got to trademark it.
Mm-hmm. All right, a less fun Are You Okay? Are you okay with Hallmark Holiday swag sales?
I never got Hallmark Holiday. Valentine's Day, if it's for Valentine's Day, you know, maybe buy a you know, one little trinket, but it's more about the dinner and the experience or whatever you get up to. But like Easter or even Halloween, any of these holidays that Hallmark likes to latch onto, there are other places to go to get things for that holiday. And 9 times out of 10, you don't really need stuff for a holiday.
I don't even like the cards. I think a poorly written sticky note that says, hey, you're cool, is better than spending $7 on a card.
Yeah. What about like really nice cards from like Papyrus and stuff like that? Like ones that are really nice and like have nice art and stuff.
No.
But no, it's way too much money. Maybe you're $400 million, you know, go to the dollar store, $1, get a nice card.
Yeah.
You're getting a sticky note card from now on.
Sweet. Love it.
Well, you're getting a sticky note. You're both getting a sticky note card from me. You know that, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I totally do. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Guaranteed.
It's probably just a text, actually, that says happy day.
Happy day to you. I spent 10 cents on this when you used to pay for text messages. Okay. So I don't like the holidays, the fake holidays that we just sort of market and sell. And it seems like there's more of these going on, right? Like we look at some of these marathons, half marathons, these run days, these colorful paint days. You know, it is. I think it's a cultural appropriation from some of the things that go on in India in that culture, celebrating color and those festivals. So there are all kinds of things that get stolen. And then we make them be, you know, these super amazing, look what I did, I ran through the paint day. And when really there's some cultural significance for many people with those things. And this sucks when people take full advantage of that stuff. Thousands of Canadians wore orange shirts, sweaters, and jackets to mark the first National Day for Truth and Reconciliation last Thursday. Unfortunately, there are some who think this can be marketed just like a normal Hallmark holiday. It's true. Orange Shirt Day has been around for almost a decade. In that time, orange shirts have become a symbol of recognition of the harms caused by the residential school system. Support for survivors, indigenous groups have been using unique designs to help fundraise and further the cause for reconciliation. Even that Facebook logo, right, that was put on Facebook, you know, the guy who drew that, it was hard to find the artist because other companies had taken that drawing and basically used it as their own. Right. So it's people are pinching stuff left and right. Orange shirts have also been popping out in various online stores, though, with the design stolen outright, just literally taken by people apparently looking to just profit off of this day. Here's more from John Waugh.
But there are some who are stealing the powerful symbolism of these shirts and trying to sell them for pure profit.
We have no idea who's selling them or, you know, what the funding is being used for.
Making matters even worse, some of the designs stolen directly from indigenous artists.
When people are just taking people's art and slapping it on a t-shirt and selling it, then no one can answer that question about what does the design actually mean.
The Orange Shirt Society has provided a list of partner retailers, including major names like London Drugs and Hudson's Bay.
So there you go.
For smaller campaigns like that of Tina Taphouse, legitimacy can be confirmed through conversation.
That's what I find amazing about this, is to be able to have conversations with people.
Hard to imagine some would see these prints symbolic of truth and reconciliation and use them to repeat a pattern of harm. John Hua, Global News.
It's incredibly disturbing that I guess some people are so naive, they just go and steal it, whatever. But you see this all the time online. You see these, even some mega big companies coming at small independents that, you know, plant trees for every t-shirt that's been sold. People who are just trying to make a difference. And these big companies will steal their stuff. It's absolutely disturbing.
I just don't understand. Sorry, just one point I want to make. I don't understand where the thought process comes in before somebody decides to steal that design and take the money and just go, yeah, I'm okay with doing this.
It's ignorant. They don't even think, they see it as opportunity and they don't think that there's a meaning behind it. That's what it is. If you want to be generous, you could call it naive, but it's ignorant and greedy. And this is where it drives me crazy when people say, oh, capitalism is so terrible. No, capitalism is not terrible. Capitalism inspires. Greed is not capitalism. Greed is greed, not to be forgotten. I want to get one more here. Are you okay? Are you okay with nuts?
Nuts?
Nuts.
Oh, nuts? Yeah, I just devoured a peanut butter bagel that was fantastic. And coming as someone who lost the ability to have peanuts, and you have it back, it's a good time. Love it.
Mm. Yeah, family allergy.
When I'm like getting really wild, I have unsalted cashews.
Whoa. Wild and out.
Holy cow. I can't keep up with you anymore, Brendan Kelly.
I know.
A fruit with a good source of fiber. They also make the best kind of butter. It's no wonder why squirrels try to stash lots of them away for the winter. They usually do this in trees, but not this squirrel. No, the squirrel in this story found a far more unconventional place to stash his secret supply of nuts in someone's truck. The squirrel grabbed hundreds of nuts, all about the size of lemons, those are big nuts, and hid them all over this poor guy's truck, about 190 liters worth of nuts. I did not know you could measure in nuts in liters. Here's more from WDYAY, WDAY News.
A lot of places inside the radiator fan, all the way through here. That corner's been covered full with walnuts.
As the winter storage hideout for hundreds of nuts. Each about the size of a small lemon.
It was planning on camping there for the winter.
Bill has cleaned out 42 gallons of black walnuts from his truck. In every crack and crevice of his Avalanche, the engine compartment, fenders, nothing is off limits.
I had to pull the fenders off and clean all the walnuts out. I thought I had them all, took it down the road, turned the corner. I found one rolling inside the windshield cowl where the wipers go.
Bill's dog, Asher, is beside himself. That pesky little red squirrel seems to taunt him. And to think this just happened over a few days the truck was parked.
It's one red squirrel that's doing this as far as going into the pickup.
Bill got most of the black walnuts out, but a few are not retrievable.
I have some rolling around inside the frame rails as well that I can't get that.
Can you hear it?
I can hear him. Yes.
One might say it's driving him nuts.
Oh.
All right, the number of collected nuts could produce almost 200 jars worth of peanut butter, if they were peanuts. Not even Ryan could eat that much peanut butter. And he loves peanut butter.
I could in a year. Not over a winter. That's some squirrel numbers there. I can't match that. But give me a year and I'll do it. I'll gain 300 pounds, but I'll do it.
4 jars a week.
This is the Shift Podcast.
I don't know if you heard the news over the last couple of days. A few years ago, there was the Panama Papers, and now there's the Pandora Papers. Dun, dun, dun. We hear this conversation about all these rich people hiding their money. Put it in an offshore bank account. We've heard about it from movies and all those things, and I don't know about you, but I often think about, I hope there's a time in my life where I have enough money that I need an offshore bank account. I think that'd be cool. But it scares me to think that someone else has my money and I don't even know what country it's in. But maybe that's just my way of thinking because I don't have $3, 4, 5 million kicking around. Michael Smarts with University of Toronto. He's an economist and understands all these economics things to help us understand what's going on. Michael Smart, thank you very much for sharing your time with us so generously here on The Shift. I appreciate it.
Happy to be here, Shane.
So let's start with the basics. Pandora Papers, hacked documents of people who are hiding money and moving money. We need to understand some pieces of this are legal. Some pieces of it are gray area and some pieces of it are flat out illegal. How do we as the non-needing offshore bank accounts people understand what's going on, Michael?
Well, you're absolutely right, Shane. This is a massive dump of documents. We're all still trying to understand what's in there, but the basics are pretty clear. These are details, confidential details that someone got somehow about thousands of transactions involving these offshore banking centers and offshore bank accounts. Basically, we're talking about tax havens here. They could be little islands in the Caribbean. They could be little islands off the coast of Europe. And they can be places right here in North America. There's certain jurisdictions where it's pretty easy to do this stuff right at home, as a matter of fact.
So I kind of hear this, and maybe this is too simplistic. I hear this as Michael and I, we had a new endeavor, and we made some money in a different country that doesn't track money quite the same way. So we took our earnings and we put it into an account where nobody in Canada and Canada Revenue really knows about it yet. And we're just going to kind of leave it there. And then if we wanted to bring it to Canada and buy a house, then we'd probably have to pay tax on it then. But in the meantime, we don't have to pay tax on it, and we could move it to other places that we don't have to pay tax either to make more money. Is that too simplistic?
Well, Shane, legally, I'm not allowed to give you tax advice. But be careful if you're going that route, because you must pay, if you're a Canadian resident, you must pay tax in Canada on your income, no matter where it's earned in the world. That's for individuals. We'll talk later about corporations. Fair Canadian enough. Corporations get a better deal. They don't have to pay tax on everything they earn in tax havens.
Right.
But you and I, if we have a bank account there, we should be reporting everything we earn. And we're not just talking about bank accounts, of course, all kinds of more exotic investment vehicles. We should report our income there. And let CRA decide whether we owe tax here at home.
Yeah.
So, you know, in reality, do Canadians and others who invest into these offshore centers, are they reporting everything back home? We don't know. We suspect that they're not. There might be a significant amount of tax evasion going on. Even the Canada Revenue Agency estimates that only about 25, maybe 50% of Canadians who have those accounts tell the truth about what they've got in them. So yeah, there is some tax evasion going on through those centers. But as your question suggested, there's a lot of other reasons why money is flowing into these centers. It's not all about tax evasion.
Well, I think that you said it right there. The hairs on the back of my neck went up when you said, let Canada Revenue decide, right? And that's what most Canadians will go, I don't want to let Revenue Canada decide, right? I want to tell Revenue Canada what I'm doing and then not give them any more info. I think that's a pretty normal view on how many people look at taxes in general. So it must be appealing for people to do this.
Well, tax havens are not for you and me, as you know, Shane. The the people who are involved in these transactions are not what you or I, or I think a lot of your listeners would call the little guy going up against CRA. These are highly wealthy individuals or large corporations who are engaged in these activities. And, you know, I think that might change the attitude of the average Canadian to what's going on here. And they might want to know, you know, a few things about it. Just how much money is there? How rich is rich in Canada? Well, you know, if we don't know everything about people's wealth holdings, then we can't even measure how much inequality there is in our country, how wealthy the wealthy truly are. And we can't be sure that they're paying their fair share of taxes. Each of us individually, I suppose, you know, wants to pay the smallest amount of tax that they legally can. That sounds reasonable to me, maybe to your listeners. But I think we all want the system to run fairly. And if certain people have access to these offshore centers, the rest of us don't, that might challenge your notion of fairness, wouldn't it?
It would challenge the notion of fairness. That's a very good political answer. You're good. Okay, since we're going to not get political, I'm going to ask a political question and with no intention of you answering politically, but I think it seems obvious. In the election that we just had in Canada, Michael, there was one platform that said, we're going to tax the rich. We're going to tax them more. They're going to help pay their fair share. Now, that's not going to happen when the government can't even find the money, is it? So, I mean, it almost, based on the current structure, doesn't even seem possible, does it?
Well, look, I think tax evasion is something we should worry about, but I don't think it's that big a problem in Canada. We have a system that works pretty well. And, you know, we have a CRA that works pretty well. There are a few gray areas or, you know, hard to tax areas. And for sure, offshore financial centers is one of them. Now, not just Canada, but the whole global community is acting on these little tax havens, as you know, we used to call them, and trying to bring them into line, trying to get countries like the Cayman Islands, Bermuda, Barbados is a favorite one for rich Canadians, by the way, trying to get them to give us, the rest of the world, more information about what money is there and who really owns that money. And you know, it's a long process. It's a difficult process. It's like playing whack-a-mole, right? I mean, if you get one of these tax havens to start playing ball, what's to stop the money from moving to the next island down the chain? So, you know, I think we should recognize that the world is trying to make a fair tax system, making sure that the truly wealthy are paying their fair share of taxes. It's a hard process. And you know, this will continue. But I think that we can all have... I don't know, Shane. I mean, you know, your politics might be different, but the thing that I emphasize is we're not talking about ordinary Canadians engaging in these activities. It's a very specialized group of people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, and it's hard to sit with it because I kind of sit with it and go, well, if I could afford to have the best accountant in the world and the best or best accountant in Canada and the best lawyer in Canada and I could afford it, why wouldn't I use their skills to protect my money? I mean, I would love to say that I wouldn't be a hypocrite if I fell into $50 million, Michael, but I'm willing to bet that if my $50 million becomes $100 million or my $50 million becomes $30 million, if I hire the right people, wouldn't all of us kind of choose that? And I think that that's kind of the crossroads where most of us sit here now and say, yeah, damn right, pay your share. But at the same time, you're like, won the lottery, what am I going to do, right? It's a bit of a crossroads.
You're absolutely right. Tax nerds like me, we talk about two different terms. We talk about tax evasion, which is the illegal stuff. And then we talk about tax avoidance, which is just doing the best you can for yourself inside the rules. It's not illegal. But of course, it does, if only some of us can get access to these kind of special deals and these top-notch accountants, then not everybody has the same access to tax avoidance. So the first one, tax evasion, is illegal. If you have money, if you get income in these offshore jurisdictions, you should report it to Canada Revenue Agency, but you might not, and they might not find out about it. To me, we should all agree that that's a problem, and we should, you know, help governments track these transactions better. It's not just about taxes, it's about corruption too, as I think you know. It's about all the reasons why, you know, you might want excessive, people might be looking for excessive secrecy. You know, one example that came up in these Pandora papers is the King of Jordan has used offshore financial centers to make investments in real estate around the world. King of Jordan is the king. He doesn't pay taxes in Jordan. He's not trying to minimize his taxes. He's trying to minimize scrutiny of what he's doing. And so, you know, there are these other issues around these places we should recognize. That's not that typical here in Canada, but around the world, the main reason I believe that money goes into these tax havens is a corruption or illegality of one kind or another. It's just avoiding scrutiny. So I don't think it doesn't matter what your attitude is to taxes or to the tax man. I think you can see that, you know, there's something unsavory about these big ticket transactions. Now, you know, you're right. There are other good business reasons why you might want to set up there. You might be doing business from Canada to Germany, to pick up an example you were talking about before, Shane. Mm-hmm. And then you realize, you know, you get an accountant who tells you, well, you could do business in Germany, but it'd be much better if you had a company in Barbados or in the Caymans that was doing business in Germany instead. And that's not illegal. It's not tax evasion. It's just standard issue tax planning by corporations around the world today. That's what Apple does. That's what Google does. And they find ways to make sure that they don't pay tax in Germany because of that. And they don't pay tax, of course, in the Caymans either. So, you know, again, it's how you feel about this. Apple and Google, they're not breaking the law for sure. You know, they're not doing anything illegal there, but we should still, you know, look at those transactions and realize just how much money is flowing in that direction and ask, well, you know, should tax be paid somewhere by those corporations? Why should they get a better deal than the rest of us to be able to, you know, work in Germany and not pay tax? If you and I can't do it, why should Google and Apple be allowed to do it? That's how I see it. I do see it as a fairness issue here and a transparency issue. It's just something we should all understand better than we do.
Well, I look at the local startups, right? You've got some technology guy who's built an amazing search engine and he's trying to, you know, start up in Vancouver or Winnipeg or whatever. And the reality is that he's got to pay full tilt on taxes while the monster he's trying to, the David and Goliath, if you will, that he's trying to take down is not playing by the same rules he's not playing by. A great example of that was Spotify. Spotify started in a place where the music rules were different for licensing so they could become big enough to get the leverage to do it in the places where the rules weren't in their favor, right? I mean, that's pretty good business.
And the tax rules were different there too. They got a better tax deal because of where they were located.
Yeah. And so that's a lot of people say that's just good business though, Michael, but what's the impact on the rent? Because if you and I, if we created a business and we did it that way, we'd be like, we're geniuses. So what's the impact on the rest of us?
Well, so what do we have to worry about here? We have to worry about lost tax revenue, but I don't think that's a particularly big deal. Canada Revenue Agency thinks they only lose $2 billion, maybe $3 billion a year through people hiding income in these tax havens and not reporting it in Canada. You know, maybe they're lowballing it, but that sounds like a reasonable number. And, you know, $1 billion is still serious money, but it's compared to the overall take of the Canadian government, it's not much. So I don't think it's mostly the lost tax revenues we should worry about. What you said about the little guy going up against the big global multinational company that's not paying taxes anywhere, I'm more worried about that. And there's way too much of that in Canada. Again, none of us want to pay taxes, but the idea that if you go to your local bricks and mortar store, I'm switching from income taxes to sales taxes, but the ideas are the same. Mm-hmm. You go to your local bricks and mortar store and you're paying, here in Ontario, you pay 13%. If you're in Alberta, it's only 5%, but you're paying sales taxes. Whereas, you know, until this year, you could very legitimately go online, buy something abroad, have it delivered one way or another and avoid taxes altogether. And, you know, that just puts bricks and mortar at a disadvantage. It puts the little guy at a disadvantage relative to large corporations. And so this problem exists in sales taxes around the world, but income taxes too. I just want to see the level playing field, little guy have a chance to get big. And then, you know, we'll see what opportunities to hide the cash there are. But if we don't level the playing field, we're not going to see new businesses rise up and, you know, come up with new ideas, be new job creators. We're not going to have, you know, the kind of the engine of growth from small business that we all hope we can get.
So in the economics of this, though, wouldn't it perpetuate the monopoly in this fashion? I mean, because we saw yesterday with Facebook, and it's unrelated to the economics of it, but I mean, Facebook had a typo in their geek typing and went down all around the world on multiple companies, multiple platforms, because it all went through one pipeline. But doesn't that translate that into money? Monopoly control. When you've got these companies like Amazon that are killing the little guy, and we wonder why this homogenization takes place and that we can't get variety, we can't get you know, good deals on shipping. Anyone in business in Canada, myself included, with my businesses, will say the number one hog tie in Canadian business is actually Canada Post. We can't compete in shipping the way that other countries can compete and other companies can compete. So, but doesn't this notion of this uneven playing field create that monopoly and just make it worse?
Well, look, you know, even 5 years ago, Shane, I probably would have disagreed. I would have said, you know, big tech are the biggest innovators maybe I've seen in my lifetime. You know, that they've changed everything. They've disrupted markets. Mm-hmm. They brought us new ways of, you know, enjoying our lives. And the government shouldn't stand in the way of that. But I think there is a change happening. I think that we are seeing, you know, them more and more, not as innovators, but as monopolies. You know, they still offer great services at very low prices compared to what people experienced in the past. You know, you think of the music industry of Spotify and what we used to pay for music in hard copy forms. Perfect example of the great benefits that have come from these services. But I think more and more we're recognizing just how massive the profits are associated with those operations, how they're going to a very few around the world, and how those companies more and more are using their powers to stand in the way of new innovations. That's a real worry. And that's something that, you know, it's not just about taxes, but other ways in which we regulate the Facebooks and the Googles of the world. But it's something that governments, I think, will have to tackle over the next 10 years, make sure that that concentration of capital and of know-how doesn't, you know, stand in the way of further progress and new businesses popping up in the future.
Yeah, there's an awful lot of conspiracies around, even in the car industry, right? That many independents were building more efficient engines years and years ago, and the big car companies would just gobble them up and suppress the technology because they didn't need it at the time, right? And we would be in a completely different place. Now, those are just conspiracies. They're out there. There's a lot of articles written on them. But it is a good example of when we look at the economics of being able to move money without consequence here and now. Return on investment's a big deal. Is it an issue of it's just not worth the government to chase it at this point because it'll cost us more to try to figure it out than it would be for us than what we would get?
Well, you're absolutely right. And it is tied into these tax havens and this tax avoidance. Google and Apple have these massive profits from their existing operations. Big question they face is, well, how do we bring it back home without paying taxes at home? And home in this case really means the United States. And a classic strategy has been just to buy new corporations, to do exactly what you said, buy the startups, bring them into the empire. And that's a way of delivering value for shareholders that doesn't trigger a lot of taxes at home. So the tax system, I think, contributes to that concentration within those companies. And it's something, you know, that we could address and the governments are trying to address. If Google was paying fair taxes everywhere and didn't have those incentives to build up the cash in the tax havens, I think it might level the playing field in those other ways you're talking about too, make it easier for startups to kind of grow naturally.
If we did that with cash, if we did with cash and bought houses though in other countries, we would call that money laundering though, wouldn't we?
Well, the tax havens are used for money laundering. I don't know how easy that is in Canada today. More and more of the provinces are trying to crack down on money laundering. Canada's been a bit slow compared to other countries, but more and more when you buy property, you have to really show who you are in Canada. So, you know, I don't think any Canadian is investing into a tax haven in order to round trip to bring the money back and buy property anonymously in Canada. I don't think that's a standard strategy, but you're right. A big part of these classic tax havens is not tax evasion. It's money laundering. It's just hiding your identity and hiding the source of your cash. Mm-hmm. And again, you know, I just think it's something we can all agree we should shut down. And in this Pandora, you know, not every name that's in the Pandora papers is engaged in that kind of behavior by any means. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we should welcome these kind of revelations. We should encourage governments just to get more transparency. Let's find out what's happening in the tax havens, but let's find out what's happening here too. Let's find out who the true owners of all these companies are who are buying up assets of various kinds. Let's get the government releasing that information to the public, something that they're very reluctant to do here in Canada. It's a basic transparency measure. Other countries are doing it. Why doesn't Canada do it too?
Well, and I would go as far as to say that sometimes buying a company and letting it die saves you more money than it was always the Donald Trump thing, right? Oh, Donald Trump, he's gone broke so many times, blah, 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 his businesses. Well, sometimes it's actually more beneficial to actually buy a company and let it die for the tax benefit than it is to support the company. And as cold-hearted as that sounds, I mean, that can be a real thing. So is that we often look at this, Michael, we sit here as normal everyday worker bees looking at this going, oh, ethics, this is an ethical problem. But is it more of just a policy issue of the way that money moves in Canada? Can we be better at it?
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, we can't rely on taxpayers to do the right thing. We have to have rules in place that are fair for everybody. And I'm not sure that we do in Canada right now. I think we make it too easy for the wealthy to park their money offshore and entirely legally gives them ways to reduce the tax they pay in Canada on that offshore money. So even if they're not hiding it from the government, there are important situations in which they just don't owe money in Canada because of how that income is piling up for them in the offshore financial center. So that's just one example of how we can improve policy in Canada, make the system fairer, and remove these incentives. Because, I mean, none of us benefit if wealthy Canadians want their money outside the country for tax reasons. So we could tighten up those rules. Like I said as well, just transparency. I don't see anything wrong with, like, we don't all want our neighbors to know, you know, what our wealth is, what our assets are. But when it comes to a corporation that's doing business, you know, buying assets, entering into contracts, we should all have a right to know who owns that business, who ultimately benefits from those transactions. And why can't that information be public? The system right now, the government asks, banks and real estate agents and so on to collect that information and then hang on to that information in case we come and ask for it later. Why not have a system where, like other countries do, where there's just a public registry? And if you're doing business with a company or you hear about a company, you can just look up its owners. You can find out where it does business and where it's headquartered. That would help us all have confidence in the system in Canada, and it would at the same time make it easier to shut down money laundering. Why the government doesn't do it, I do not understand.
Well, it seems maybe it's too simple, Michael, but if Netflix and Google paid taxes in Canada on all of the services they provide, it seems to me that that would be beneficial for Canada. So when you... they're doing business in Canada, even though it's non-tangible, electronic, digital, whatever. So if you sit down with your economics buds, you know, real good nerd session, you know, how do you guys talk about this in a whole, like, you know, you guys are sitting down looking at these Pandora papers going, man, what do we do here? How do, like, professionals look at this? What do you guys talk about?
Well, we talk about what you and I are talking about, Shane. There is some tax nerd economists like me who are really concerned about the revenue loss. But there are a lot more who are concerned about the sign of widening wealth inequality around the world. This idea that there's a global elite who are earning more and more profits off of these massive investments. And the idea that these offshore financial centers are just facilitating a widening gap between rich and poor around the world. And then the last thing that the tax nerds want to think about is, well, how should we tax corporations? If there's a business that does its inventing processes in the United States, you know, somewhere in Silicon Valley, but then it sells to Canadians using products that they had built by a manufacturing facility in China, you know, it's just a very hard question. Who should get the tax from that? Should it be China? Should it be Canada? Right. Should it be the United States as the owners of that intellectual property? And so it's a very hard problem. You know, we wouldn't want the same investment and the same income tax in all three of those countries. That would not be fair to Google or Apple, right?
It's true.
But we don't want to tax in none of them either. And it seems more and more that's what's happening. Double or triple non-taxation of investments. So one thing that the tax nerds are trying to figure out right now is, you know, is there a better way of figuring out where the income really belongs and where it should be taxed? So world leaders, the OECD, and a lot of tax nerds like me spend a lot of time thinking about that now. What's an alternative system that we could use? And, you know, it might require countries giving up some of their sovereignty. Right now, Canada gets to decide what is income of companies who operate in Canada, as you said, and how much tax should be paid. But, you know, maybe that system works only for the companies and not for the countries anymore. Maybe Canada has to give up some of its rights to figure out how to tax the Googles and the Apples and the Canadian companies too, right? To, you know, other countries or to a world body. We might lose some freedom there, some sovereignty, but the whole world might benefit if we started to coordinate, you know, as a group of countries, we started to coordinate, we could crack down on tax havens and we could crack down on the more aggressive forms of tax avoidance by these companies. And the United States under the Biden administration is actually now taking the lead in that. We might see changes over the next couple of years, I think.
Chickens and gold sound really appealing some days, doesn't it?
Chickens and gold.
Trading chickens. I'll give you three chickens for one piece of gold and that's it. Like, you know what I mean? Like it does sound particularly appealing when we get into this global economy thing.
Well, now if chickens are selling for gold, you're talking about inflation, and that's a whole other topic. I'm going to have to come back a different day for that.
I will happily talk about inflation with you and all of these affordable things. I really appreciate the time, Michael. Thank you so much for being here.
Great to talk to you. Bye-bye.
This is the Shift Podcast.
Dave Scott, do we have you?
We got you. Can you hear us?
There we go, buddy. We got you. We're having all kinds of trouble, tech trouble here on the program. Yeah. Facebook yesterday, I think we've caught a bit of the Facebook-itis. Something broke.
Maybe, you know what? I had audio issues on my show yesterday, man. Maybe it's some of that Mercury retrograde crap that's out there.
You know what? I like these segments that you've been doing about the astrological and the hippy dippy with that stuff. I've been following them on your Twitter because I love these guests. And I got to tell you, Dave, but I mean, we share an awful lot in our private conversations. I really appreciate, sort of the depth that you're taking in some of these conversations with this sort of astrophysical, astrological guests you've been putting on. I've thoroughly enjoyed it.
Well, I'm going to give credit because that is our weekend host on our YouTube and Twitch channel, Lynn Wallington. She is the brains behind all of that. I just kind of tag along on a leash like a lost puppy with it. But, you know, like one of the things that we're supposed to be in right now is this Mercury retrograde thing. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't know if I'm a big believer in this, okay? It just doesn't suit my fancy a little bit. So
I find that funny coming from you, brother.
I know. I'll talk Bigfoot all night long. I'll talk aliens, you know, ghosts, fairies, gnomes. But Mercury retrograde, I don't know. Apparently it happens three times a year between the months of January, February, June and July, September and October, where basically all hell breaks loose and screws everything up from technology to our lives. It's also a time for apparently channeling mental energy inward, reflecting, reassessing, and rethinking why we got into the creation of radio. Now, I don't know how that all works out for us, but a lot of people who are especially more spiritually inclined than yours truly and you, they tend to believe that Mercury retrograde is actually something that people need to prepare for. And it's something that can affect everything. It's kind of like when we hear the stories of, you know, people going a little haywire on a full moon.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is what I'm equating it to. I could be completely wrong, but I mean, hey, you wanted to get hippity-dippity, so that's what we are doing.
I like the hippity-dippity. I do. I don't know if I subscribe to it, but I very much appreciate the conversations around it. I guess I just like to write it off. It's kind of the way that I look at the aliens and the UFOs, right? Is that I don't really have evidence that says it's not happening. And there are a bunch of people around me that truly study and believe it. Therefore, why should I shoot it down? I don't have to celebrate it, you know, when it comes to the moon and the alignment of the whatever, whatevers, but I can appreciate it. And I had my buddy, Paul O'Neill. He's been a radio guy in Calgary and Edmonton forever. Paulie today was talking about, I'm just new to this, but I'm not sleeping. My hippy dippy friends tell me it's the Mercury retrograde and that it affects people. And then if you search Mercury retrograde on any of the socials, you're going to find a long list of tweets and conversations about people that are talking about it. I think it's a time to, you know, recreate yourself newly and do your meditation and all those things.
Yeah, and you know, a lot of people abide by it, especially those who are very in tune with their own personal spiritual growth, whether it's connecting with their source or the universe, or reading everything from tarot cards to tea leaves and every type of esoteric reading that there is. And, you know, some people abide by it. They feel better over it. They prepare for it. You know, like some people will take holidays during Mercury retrograde, so that way they don't have bad times at work or accidentally, you know, get hurt or fired or quit their job or have temper tantrums or hang up the phone or forget to put their mute button on the radio microphone. So a lot of people are out there. They're paying attention to it. How much can you actually do it? I really don't know. Like I said, when it comes to Mercury retrograde, I'm not a firm believer in it, but I can say this, all right? Sometimes weird things happen at weird times. And a lot of those times, those weird things happen at Mercury retrograde. Example, yesterday, my board that I run my audio through, like we all have an audio board, it kept on echoing back. Couldn't hear it yesterday. I run my show today. My board is working perfectly. So I think it just did it to piss me off, saying, there's Mercury retrograde for you, Dave. Now take that one and shove it up your nose.
Your console is out to get you. I love it.
Absolutely.
All right. I find it really fantastic that you study all these wild things and that Mercury retrograde is sort of your line in the sand of all of it. I love that, though. That's the best part about Spaced Out Radio joining us here on The Shift. Okay, you talk often about stories that you share in Canada. Who is running the UFO show, the UFO show, and let's start by asking you this question for people who haven't heard this segment before or in a long time. What is a ufologist? Let's start there, and then we'll introduce the Canadian from the article that you shared with me.
All right. A ufologist is somebody who studies the field of UFOs, or now the fancy term, unidentified aerial phenomena. What is happening? Where are the sightings happening? What kind of sightings are happening? How often is it happening? And they are taking the data from that, and they are putting it into a lot of compartmentalization on trying to find any sort of data pattern to see what is happening with these strange anomalies that are happening in the sky. And so that would probably, I mean, there's so many different definitions to it. I mean, it could be somebody who's chasing down black triangle craft. It could be somebody who is chasing down government records for UFO research. What is the government not talking about? There's a lot of different avenues with a ufologist. It is a very blanketed term.
Okay. In Canada, one of the pieces that you've been digging into and working on is trying to find out, where does the info go? The article that you shared with me doesn't go to anybody. I don't want to not call him special, because, you know, I don't want someone to feel like they're not important, but it's not as, I don't know, military or high level of a person or career that you might think of. Where do we go?
Well, apparently the Canadian military used to have a UFO desk, and they allegedly shut down that UFO desk and were doing nothing with the files. So this gentleman who is named Chris Rutkowski out of Winnipeg, Manitoba, very smart man, very detail-oriented man. He works for the University of Manitoba, where eventually all of his files were going. He used to write sci-fi books. And for some reason, he somehow just threw it out there to the Canadian government and the Canadian Department of National Defense and said, hey, if you're not doing anything with those UFO files, send them to me. I want to look them over. So about 25 years ago, the Department of National Defense started sending Rutkowski all of these low-level UFO reports. Nothing top secret. He does not have security clearance or anything like that. And he has done nothing wrong. Zero. All he has done is compile Canada's research every year into where the UFO sightings are happening. But here's where it gets interesting, and we really have to give credit to a gentleman and a journalist, great journalist named Daniel Otis out of Toronto, who writes for Vice Magazine. And Daniel figured out something very strange, that a lot of the reports that Chris Rutkowski are getting are reports that are being handed to him, but no one else.
Hmm.
So there are a bunch of people in Canada, from Grant, a gentleman named Grant Cameron or Ryan Stacey or a number of others in Canada who have been looking into UFOs, including members of the government who have put through Freedom of Information Act requests to the Department of National Defense and have got declined on their request for UFO reports. Now, when you file a Freedom of Information Act request, it costs you money. And when you get declined, you do not get your money back. Yet Mr. Rutkowski is getting the reports. So the big question that many of us have right now is, why is Chris Rutkowski getting the reports handed to him on a silver platter by the Department of National Defense, but when someone else in the field of ufology or even working within the Canadian government asks for some FOIA files on UFOs, the requests are sometimes denied? It does not make sense. And this is a real trouble, because for many of us, like you stated, we have been trying to figure out, what does Canada know and what is Canada doing with their UFO reports? We know we're not going to get anything top secret. Those things are going straight to NORAD and into the hands of the American government and a group called the Five Eyes, which is the United Kingdom, New Zealand, Australia, the United States, and Canada. And that's where the reports, the big time reports, are going. But even with some of the smaller reports, the Canadian military, along with the FOIA requests and other departments, are denying requests for those reports. Yet some of those reports all end up on the desk of Chris Rutkowski. So there's a lot of people wondering, why is Rutkowski getting them when every other Canadian out there who wants to file a FOIA request, and anybody can at any time, is being denied? It does not make sense, and it's ruffled a few feathers as we try to break open this topic in Canada.
Has this Chris guy published any of it? I mean, is he sharing it? Is it,
yes.
You know, how, what's happening?
Every year he publishes the UFO report, where he goes province to province to detail how many sightings went across Canada this year, where are the hot spots. Usually the hot spots are in British Columbia, near Vancouver, and the lower mainland, in and around Toronto, and in and around Montreal and Quebec City. And that is mainly the reason why, if you look at a map, obviously, those are the most populous areas of Canada. But what he isn't doing is writing sci-fi books on these topics. He may be using them for information, but he's not using the information for that. He is, and he's doing nothing wrong. Once again, Chris Rutkowski does amazing work in providing the UFO files annually for the mainstream media to check out. Usually it ends up in the Globe and Mail or the National Post. But the big thing is, and the big argument is, why is nobody else allowed to do it? And I shouldn't say that, Shane. People are allowed to do it, but the question is, why aren't they getting the information for it? So that's like somebody in Ottawa handing you fresh papers right off the Prime Minister's desk, but not giving it to any other media outlet. As a media person, you would love it, because you're the guy. Mm-hmm. You know, you're the person who gets it. You're going to break the story. But when other people are asking for it, they're getting denied. And that's what's upsetting to a lot of people in the UFO field. And like I said, I talked to one person who works in Ottawa, who is one of my sources on this topic, And this person literally stated to me that he was right upset because a few of the files that he specifically requested for his boss, who is an MP, was denied by the DND. And yet all he had to do was call up Chris Rutowski to see if he could get him. So in the end, why is Chris Rutowski being the man where everybody's got to go to when the government could just send everybody in Canada the report? Or put it on a website or a mailing list where anybody can grab the information. It doesn't make sense.
Well, Chris, so this guy, as you said, described Chris. He went and basically asked for the ability to do this. They gave it to him. Has anyone just gone and just asked for it? Which I would like to clarify, by the way, if I got inside scoop from the prime minister's desk, paper from his desk, let's be honest, it would probably just be a picture of the prime minister. But I felt like that was needed to be said. Do you just go ask? Yeah, right. Do you just go ask the guy and say, you know, do you want to CC me now? Or is it... there's just no red tape trail to follow.
Well, the big thing with Chris Rutowski is he'll tell you he's not a UFO guy. He loves the subject of UFOs, but he rarely does interviews. He doesn't like the state of ufology, tries to stay away from it as much as he can. He just loves the statistics of it all, which is great. We need that. We absolutely need that. Everybody has their niche and their role in ufology, and that is great. Okay, he compiles very sound numbers, and that's what we want to see. But this isn't on the fault of Rutowski. This is on the fault of everybody from NAV Canada to the Department of National Defense. And as the person I talked to in Ottawa wants to know, they feel that whoever the new Minister of National Defense is going to be needs to answer this question. And this may be the subject that actually blows this story open, finally, in Ottawa, where it could come out in the House of Commons and say, could you please explain why Mr. Rutowski, who is a UFO statistician, is getting all of these reports while other Canadians, including people in this party or parties, are being denied requests? Please explain that.
Well, there's a lot of questions to be asked. That's for sure.
Yes.
And love to see those stats. I would like to see like a hot heat map of all the little dots. I mean, that would be, you know, if you look at a statistician versus somebody who might be a little bit more website program, you know, sort of educated or hobbyist. It'd be nice to see like a Google map with hotspots of where people have seen these things. So it does make you start to think. That's really cool stuff. Dave Scott, it's great to hear your voice, brother. Thank you so much joining us here on The Shift. And may the Mercury retrograde bring you peace and all the namastes that you need in your life.
Thank you for always bringing us across Canada talking UFOs, my friend. You take care.
Love the UFOs. You take care.
Thanks for listening to The Shift Podcast.
Make sure you subscribe, rate, and review the show and share with anyone you like. Get it on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and CuriousCast.ca.
It's Shauna, and I might be a bad parent because my kids think french fries are vegetables.
Hey, it's Ryan, and I might be a bad parent because I went out for wings when my wife was in the hospital after giving birth.
Johnny here. I might be a bad parent because in my house, the tooth fairy gives pocket change.
But we're not alone. Len emailed us and said his six-year-old daughter's Tarzan moment going from love seat to lazy boy by curtains made him more proud than any dance recital.
And Andy left his two-year-old at the rink.
All right, guys, I'm sure we're not alone. Like Andy's kid.
For stories and confessions like this, make sure you check out our podcast.
It's called Bad Parents, and it's available wherever you get your podcasts.
I left a glove at the rink.